Preface by Sangharakshita at Majjhima Loka, 23rd of May 2000. We needs must love the highest when we see it is one of the best known lines of a famous poet. But what do we mean by the highest? How do we recognise it? And what makes us love it? For me, the highest has always meant the true, the beautiful and the good, and whatever embodies them, whether separately or in combination and to whatsoever degree. Even in my pre-teen years, I recognised that in certain poems, paintings and pieces of music, there was expressed a sensibility, a consciousness, even a state of being, that was immensely superior to my own. And the reason I was able to recognise it as superior was that this more developed sensibility, this higher consciousness or state of being, existed in me in germinal form. Nor was it a merely theoretical recognition. A positive emotional response was involved, a response of love. Literature and the fine arts led me to religion and mysticism. In my teens, I became acquainted with the teachings of the major world religions, as well as with the principal Western philosophies, and realised not only that I was not a Christian, but that I was in fact a Buddhist, and always had been one. I therefore took the first opportunity of publicly affirming that I was a Buddhist by taking the refuges and precepts from a Buddhist monk on the occasion of a Wesak celebration. A few months later, the army transported me to India, where, after demobilising myself, I spent 2 years as a freelance wandering ascetic before being ordained as a monk and going to live with my first teacher, the Venerable Jagdish Kashyap in Benares. With Kashyapji, I studied Pali, Abhidharma and logic. One of the texts I studied with him was the Dhammapada, an anthology of the Buddha's sayings that, at an early date, came to be included in the Pali Canon. In it occurs the following verses. Quote, many people out of fear flee for refuge to sacred hills, woods, groves, trees and shrines. In reality, this is not a safe refuge. In reality, this is not the best refuge. Fleeing to such a refuge, one is not released from all suffering. He who goes for refuge to the enlightened one, to the truth, and to the spiritual community, and who sees with perfect wisdom the four Aryan truths, namely, suffering, the origin of suffering, the passing beyond suffering, and the Aryan eight-membered way leading to the pacification of suffering, for him this is a safe refuge, for him this is the best refuge. Having gone to such a refuge, one is released from all suffering. End quote. In taking the refuges and precepts and thereby affirming that I was a Buddhist, I was doing much more than simply joining a particular socio-economic group. The phrase, taking the refuges, though in common use, is in any case highly misleading and does not even render correctly the original Indic expression. As the Dhammapada verses makes clear, one goes for refuge to the Buddha, the Dharma and the Sangha, and it is this going for refuge to the three jewels that makes one a Buddhist. In other words, a Buddhist is one who is committed to the actual realization of the supreme spiritual values of which the three jewels are the embodiment. For the Buddhist, it is the three jewels that are the highest, and it is therefore the three jewels that he or she strives to see ever more clearly and love ever more ardently. Going for refuge is thus an act of the greatest importance. Though I realized this at the time I was studying with Kashyapji, I was then far from realizing the full extent of that importance. In particular, I did not realize the absolute centrality of the act of going for refuge at all stages of the spiritual life, not just at the beginning. Neither did I realize that the degree to which one was a Buddhist was determined not by one's ecclesiastical status, not by whether one was monk or layman, nun or laywoman, but simply and solely by the degree to which one went for refuge to the Three Jewels. As I was later to declare, commitment is primary, lifestyle secondary. Realizing the absolute centrality of the act of going for refuge and working out the practical and theoretical implications of the fact of that centrality was a task that took me many years and is probably not complete even now. The various stages of the process are fully described in The History of My Going for Refuge and need not be recounted here. Suffice it to say that the turning point came in 1962 in Kalimpong in the eastern Himalayas, where I had been living for the last 12 years. By what some would see as a coincidence, others as an example of Jungian synchronicity, on the morning after the very day on which I received the Padmasambhava initiation from Kashu Rinpoche, I acquired, without knowing what it contained, a copy of a Tibetan text that described, inter alia, the going for refuge and prostration practice, with Padmasambhava, the greatly precious guru, as the central figure. The practice came as revelation to me. It involved not the mind, but also the body and one's speech. As such, it was a total practice. It exemplified, in highly concrete fashion, the fact that one went for refuge, not just mentally, but with one's whole being. And under Kashu Rinpoche's guidance, I took it up enthusiastically. The text I had acquired was a Nyingma text, and the reason for its having Padmasambhava as the central figure of the going for refuge and prostration practice was that the greatly precious guru was the founder of the Nyingma school. The other schools of Tibetan Buddhism had their own founders as a central figure of the practice. There was thus a common iconic pattern, a pattern in which the school's founder was seated on an enormous lotus with bodhisattvas, arhats, human Buddhas and teachers, and the volumes of the scriptures occupying, respectively, similar lotuses to his right and left, in front of him and behind. All five lotuses were shown as springing from a common stem, in this way forming between them what was known as the refuge tree. Tankas, or painted scrolls, usually contained several scores of such figures, including many that were of significance only for this or that school or lineage of Tibetan Buddhism. For many years, the members of the Western Buddhist order did the going for refuge and prostration practice in accordance with Nyingma tradition as I had done, i.e. with Padmasambhava as the central figure of the refuge tree. But the Western Buddhist order was an ecumenical Buddhist order, in that it did not identify itself exclusively with any one school of Eastern Buddhism, but, on the contrary, respected them all, admired them all, and looked to them all for sources of inspiration and guidance. It was therefore increasingly felt that the way we performed the going for refuge and prostration practice should reflect the order's ecumenical attitude. In 1992, I therefore devised and published a new refuge tree, a refuge tree in which the Buddha, as the ultimate source of all Buddhist teachings, occupied the central place, and in which were included key figures from the entire Buddhist tradition, whether Indian, Chinese, Tibetan, or Japanese, and whether historical or mythical. It is this new refuge tree, the refuge tree of the Western Buddhist order, that Kulananda describes in this book. According to a well-known art historian, if an iconography contains a number of sufficiently powerful symbols, it can positively alter a philosophical system. Quote, "The points of dogma for which no satisfactory image can be created tend to be dropped, and popular religious expression and episodes which have scarcely occupied the attention of the theologians tend to grow in importance if they produce a compelling image." End quote. Buddhism has produced a number of such compelling images, the most important of which have a close connection with its principal doctrines. Among the best known of these images are the Wheel of Life, the Mandala, and the Refuge Tree, the last of them being a composite image, incorporating as it does the symbols of the tree and the lotus, both of which are images in their own right. It is because it is a compelling image that the refuge tree is able to function as the object of the going for refuge and prostration practice, and in this way to transform our lives and bring us nearer to our goal of enlightenment for the sake of all living beings. Though Teachers of Enlightenment contains much useful information about the figures of the refuge tree of the Western Buddhist order, about the Buddhist scriptures, and about the historical development of Buddhism, it is above all a call to spiritual practice. In particular, it's a call to give oneself to the going for refuge and prostration practice, a practice to which Kulananda has committed himself for many years. As such, it will be of interest and value not only to members of the Western Buddhist order everywhere in the world, but also to all Buddhists, inasmuch as they themselves go for refuge to the Three Jewels, and to those students of comparative religion who may be interested to see what it is that gives life, energy, and inspiration to a new Buddhist movement.